The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
All right, we're back here for another episode of Midwest Swing. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We are part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon _ Warren. Producing today is Tom Schreier, co-founder of Cold Omaha, at TSchreier3 on Twitter. Tom, how's your Twitter account doing today?
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. I don't take on the haters like you do, these amateur scouts on Twitter.
Yeah. I tweeted earlier today a gif of Uncle Rico from Napoleon Dynamite, and I felt like it was maybe a little abstract. He throws the stake and hits Napoleon in the face, and they fall off the bike, whatever. But it was always about Uncle Rico missing his calling as an NFL quarterback. And I feel like what people are saying on Twitter gives us the vibe that they think they've missed their calling as professional scouts. And so it just drives me crazy that all these people have these huge takes. Someone who has huge takes, but for good reason, is Mike Berardino. He is in studio today, hanging out with us on the second day of the draft, which has just begun. We will chat about that a little bit too as things come up. And beyond that, how are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing very well. I've never been introduced as having huge takes, but I'll try to live up to that.
Well, I think they're good takes. I think people obviously should follow you at Mike Berardino, Berardino, right?
Yes.
Okay, on Twitter. If you are not following him and you are following anyone else for your Twins takes, you are making a grave mistake. So please make sure to do that. Mike was on site at Target Field, as was I, as was Tom. And Tom was doing a little more game coverage, helping me out with the transcription. But Mike, obviously with the number one overall pick, the buzz was kind of all over the place for the last however long you want to go back, whether it was Hunter Green at the very beginning as someone fans wanted, Brendan McKay, Kyle Wright, all the way down to probably, when do you think the Royce Lewis steam really started in vain? Probably the last hour or 2 hours maybe? It seemed to me like Royce, the steam around Lewis picked up really late Monday afternoon.
Well, first of all, I don't like that word you're using. I'm tired of seeing that word, and I don't even know what the hell it means. But
steam?
I don't know what. I don't want to hear any more about
sure.
that. Thank you. But I think we know where that word emanates from. But I believe it was a D1 baseball reporter who first put it out there in the morning, and I forget his name, Fred.
Frankie Pilier.
That's it.
There you go.
And so I think he was the first one I noticed attaching Royce Lewis in a serious way to the Twins. I mean, going into the weekend, I mean, I'd always throw in Royce Lewis as a possible fallback because you did get the sense all throughout that money was going to the new system of compressed bonuses was going to be an issue that. That there wasn't a lot of separation. We've known for a couple of weeks when Thad Levine said on local radio that there was no generational player in the draft. And then, of course, I've been reporting going back to early May, maybe, that Hunter Green was not viewed as all that by the Twins. I think they brought him in last week just to make sure that they weren't missing something and also to see what the spin rates were and to ask him some questions on the makeup. But isn't it fascinating how it worked out that, obviously Brendan McKay was the one all along, the Louisville two-way guy who Tampa now has, who really could end up being he could be the generational talent. But the Twins wanted him, and they offered him. And as he said on the record right afterwards that he turned it down because he was under the impression he would be able to get a better deal somewhere else. So it wasn't important to him to be number one overall. It came down to dollars for him as well, and I guess I can't blame him on that. I think there are bigger issues and opportunity and the coaching you'll receive and the park you might eventually play in. I don't know. And there is prestige with number one. But all I know is Royce Lewis was so jacked up, he planned to go bowling and eat cake and jump in the pool.
Yeah, you mentioned not having a transcendent talent like a Steven Strasburg or a Bryce Harper on this draft. Eric Longenhagen's mock board, or not his mock, but his board, as far as future value, FV, you'll see in scouting communities a lot. He had 260 players, a handful of 55s, a few 50s, and then it was... So, I mean, not a very high-end talent pool in the eyes of an evaluator I trust a lot. Eric Longenhagen, I've met in person. He's my guy, obviously, at Fangraphs, but also is under the wing, or was under the wing, of Keith Law, who I know Keith is very polarizing, but Keith knows a lot. So, I mean, to learn from someone like Keith and then turn it into your own thing is also pretty pretty solid in his own right.
I like Eric's work, and I respect Keith, but it wasn't it the case that Keith, right to the last, continues to say that Hunter Green was one of the best high school players he'd ever seen.
It's very possible.
All in on Hunter Green. Maybe he's believing that he's, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he seemed to believe that he was a generational talent. But, you know, something else has come along here just recently that Tom and I were talking off the air before we started about the curveball as something that may be a gift versus a teachable skill or refinable skill. And if Hunter Green doesn't have his curveball yet, which apparently he does not, that is reason for pause out there for those who are fearing, Twins fans who are fearing that they missed the boat on somebody who is going to dominate the game for years to come. The SI story that Tom Verducci, the cover story about the curveball and how it's come back in full force and blowing past all the other secondary offerings and even beyond the fastball. And Houston Astros, best team in baseball, were the team that he really focused on, and Clayton Kershaw, too. But that was the first time, Tom, that I'd ever seen it suggested. It was by a general manager who was not quoted or was not named, but basically you either have it young or you're not going to have it. And Brendan McKay seems to have the spin rate and the feel for the curveball, but Hunter Green, just a pure velo guy with charisma, and so they went away from that. They were not – I don't really believe that that was something that they were going to – but I do think there were makeup concerns that he got a little wrapped up in his – in the attention he was getting from the SI cover to this old victory tour that he was taking in advance of the draft on his way to New York, and sunglasses and selfies with Joe Maddon and the sparkly – H belt buckle and the ripped jeans and some of those things. I don't know him, never met him, and he may go on and do great things, but hearing 15 minutes of Royce Lewis on a conference call and then hearing the way the Twins talked about him in his leadership capacity and his makeup and his personality and the way he makes those around him better and the energy he'll bring, and you could really sense that there was separation for them, it felt like, on that part of the ledger between he and Green.
Well, and when I asked Sean Johnson about this being a transcendent personality in the clubhouse, your Kirby Puckett, your Torrey Hunter type, and again, I didn't ask that because I feel like they need to put those expectations on him, but I do feel like every great team kind of has that guy in the room that everyone gravitates to. And I'm not saying Miguel Sano can't be that guy, but I do think they need someone, perhaps even starting in the minor leagues, When people are telling stories 30 years from now or 25 years from now, like they are about Torrey back in the mid-90s and into when he came to the big leagues, I feel like this can be that kind of guy. Beyond that, it wasn't a reach in the sense that he was expected to go 15th or 20th overall. Baseball America had him number two twice and then never lower than five. So it wasn't like the Twins reached for a Ben Revere who might have gone a round later or anything. This is still a legitimately good talent who checks off all the boxes off the field. And I saw in Baseball America, or maybe it was minorleagueball.com, all of his tools on the field are fine, and then it's just where they go up from here. Like, he's got no actual on-field weaknesses as much as it is. He's got all the tools you want. You just have to refine and develop them.
I would say that the weakness, although he was asked, I think he was slightly joking, where he said, as far as weaknesses go, I don't have any at the moment. He just needed to refine them, similar to you. Actually, the thing I kept hearing throughout the spring was that the bat is, and even the Twins will say, that the bat on any high school guy is something you have to project and wonder about, because he has faced top level competition, but it hasn't been with wood bats except in these summer showcases. He did homer at Wrigley Field with that ability, but the bat and the mechanics of his hitting have been a concern for evaluators. That was the knock on him. If there was one knock, like you say, the arm's good, the speed's great, the makeup is great. His hands are good enough to stay at shortstop or play in a number of places. I'm thinking he's got a little Ian Desmond to him in mm-hmm. that way, with the versatility and the athleticism, just a very live body. But the mechanics of the hitting were a concern enough, and maybe they just want to be thorough, that they did have, as Sean Johnson also told us last night, they had both James Rowson and Jeff Pickler look at least video of him and to try to make sure that everything works the way it's supposed to. That's going to be the last thing to really come. They think as he fills out, there'll be power. But the hit tool, the pure hit tool for average, that's something that lags, I believe.
I want to go back to Hunter Greene for just a second before we come back to Royce Lewis, because I don't want to get too far away from it. For me, and again, I am fully in the I know nothing boat. If I was a politician in the 1800s, I'd be in the know nothing party. However, when it comes to Hunter Greene, I also look at the fact that, you know, he has to develop the secondaries. There's so many boxes he has to check between now and the big leagues that are very high mountains to climb. He has to stay healthy. He has to acclimate to all the levels. He has to sustain. He's not going to throw 102 miles per hour in three or four years when he gets to the big leagues anymore. No big leaguer throws 102 as a starter. You have to sustain that. You eventually become a 98 guy, then a 96 guy, then a 94 guy. And Felix Hernandez, who threw gas when he came up, everybody transitions back. So you have to check off the boxes of staying healthy and of acclimating to professional baseball. There's just so many risk factors that I think are part of the deal. And again, there's nothing about him as a person that says he probably can't do those things. But it's like, okay, well, what if he no longer throws 102 or 100 or 98 anymore? What if he comes up and he throws 95? Well, if he's 95 and that curveball never quite gets there, or he never quite gets a feel or an arm slot for a changeup, you just spent a number one pick on a guy who the floor is extremely low on. It could be, and I know the body comps aren't the same. Tyler Kolek for the Marlins threw gas, and everyone's wanting him, and now he's not healthy, not doing anything. And so it's just like, for all the reward that he could provide, there's just so much risk there that I do think the Twins were wise to not necessarily go down that road.
Yeah, I as you know, you're hearing people who know a lot more than we do on the national scouting media hybrid world saying that they actually like, and Jim Callis is one of them, and I've known Jim since he worked at Baseball America, and he was saying openly in the final 2 weeks that he thought Mackenzie Gore was the best high school pitcher. So and he would take him number one. So, and he goes three to the Padres. If Hunter Greene weren't even clearly the best high school pitcher mm-hmm. available, how could he be a generational talent that the Twins will be ruining this, you know, yesterday for decades to come? And there's a lot of guesswork. There's a lot of projection. There's a lot of gut trusting, and you try to introduce analytics to it as well to make sure you're not missing something. But and they did that. But if I had to say, of all these guys, you know, Kyle Wright's another guy that really had climbed to the point where there was a sense that he was going to be the guy at one point. And obviously Vanderbilt pitching has done pretty well in recent years. Over the years, David Price and Walker Buehler and others that Sheffield that have people excited, thinking that they know how to churn them out. And Kyle Wright to the Braves could be yet another one who's going to be up in within 2 years and make Twins fans temporarily upset while Royce Lewis is in Double A at that time or something. But the guy that you wonder about is Brendan McKay, because he does have he has some Ruthian tendencies, mm-hmm. That left-handed swing is so easy and powerful. And then he's such an advanced pitcher, and he's got the big breaking ball, and he's just a beast. And he was this close to being a Twin, this close. If they give him his number,
yeah,
he's the guy. They never wavered on the fact that they liked him. It was always, mm-hmm. as I pointed out on Twitter just before the draft, you know, every time you thought it was down to two, it was originally in April, we were saying, well, it looks like I wrote in first week of April, the Twins are giving strong consideration to Brendan McKay and Hunter Green. And then later on it became, after Green fell by the wayside a bit, it was Kyle Wright and Brendan McKay. And then at the very last day, because the Twins did a very good job of masking to the media and to other teams just how much they liked Royce Lewis. They really did a good job on that, and that's part of it. Then it became those two, but always it was McKay in the mix, and I think that's why the comparisons between McKay and that's the comparison I'll be watching going forward even more than Hunter Green. I know people got excited about Hunter Green, especially those who just kind of dabble in this stuff.
Well, I think the instant gratification factor, which is obviously not a thing in baseball, was up for grabs in the fact that Michael Wacha came up early. He was in the same draft as Buxton, and now, again, I know people aren't happy with how Buxton's hitting, but Waka's gone through shoulder stuff and is no longer any kind of ace. He's a fairly good pitcher, but he's a guy you might take out of a grab bin and turn into a really nice pitcher, and you wouldn't have spent the number one overall pick on that kind of guy, whereas Buxton is that generational talent, assuming the hit progresses a little bit. And then there's also, I think, that dangerous thought of drafting for need. The Twins could have drafted Mark Appel. They could have drafted Mike Zunino instead of Byron Buxton. They'd be stuck with a catcher who's got a 630-something career OPS or a guy stalled out in Double A in the Phillies system, the team that didn't even draft him. None of the times he was drafted. He could be stalled out in Double A. The idea that you have to draft with today in mind is such a foolish logical fallacy that it just drives me crazy. And again, that's me understanding that Buxton, the guy they took in that draft that year, still isn't a finished product. But how do you reconcile that he made it to the big leagues before Appel did, and not by a small margin? We could write a book on Harold Reynolds' thoughts, but Harold Reynolds thought Mark Appel was going to be up that same year that he went the second time around. So the fact that Buxton beat him to the big leagues, why is everybody sleeping on that? That just makes me crazy, because it's like, the draft, it's a giant shrug emoji, and that's about it. And these people know more than we do.
Well, you got to have a take, right? You got to have a take and come strong. We're showing that again right here. But one thing that I think is a good segue for us here is that high school position players, and we're Buxton, obviously one who's yet to reach a full flower, but he's getting there. If you just look at the number one overall pick in of the last 52 drafts, the top seven career wins above replacement totals by Baseball Reference are all high school position players. And I wrote that was the entree to the Sunday story in the Pioneer Press, looking at, well, just what is the history of college pitching. And I included Matt Anderson, who is a reliever from Rice. And there were 14.
The Tigers, right?
There's four. Yes, yeah. 14 college pitchers taken over that period. And the highest WAR for any of them career was David Price, and he's tied for 10th with Darren Erstad, who was a college hitter at Nebraska, and B.J. Surhoff, I think, was 9, a college hitter from Carolina. So the top, the top seven. The top seven were all high school position players. And as Mike Radcliffe told us last night, he's been doing this forever and now more in an overseeing advisory role. He's had for a long time, a decade. He made the call as scouting director for the Twins. Nobody knows more about the draft and draft history and playing the odds than this guy. And he said, we've never been afraid as an organization to take high school players, mm-hmm. especially high school position players, and he said some teams are afraid of that. They want the more quote unquote sure thing, but the Twins have shown over and over that they are pretty good when they go after the high school kid who has upside. They know how to break that down. It's a lot of the same people. Another thing came out last night that was encouraging, I thought, for those who respect the job that the Twins have always done draft wise, scouting wise, and didn't think that that part of the system needed to overhaul. The Falvey and Levine introduced some new concepts and obviously changed a few roles around. But according to Mike Radcliffe, very respectful since they've come on board last fall. of what the Twins had done previously, the way they like to go about things, and it sounded like there were very few changes. They added some layers, I believe Radcliffe called it, and I think that's the metrics they even talked about. You know, so they're more look at exit velocity where possible. But as he pointed out, the sample size, I asked him about exit velocities for Royce Lewis. Was that data part of the equation to offset some of the traditional scouting reservations about his bat? He said they looked at that, but actually there's not enough out there from the perfect sure. game events, the Under Armour events that where you can get those things, that you can even introduce it and compare it, stack it up to people over here. So they look at it, but it still felt like just a piece and a smaller piece. But overall, this wasn't that appreciably different, the people they've taken, from what they would have done before the regime change.
So do you have that list of seven guys that were on top of the war? I remember it because it was, I would imagine, Griffey,
A-Rod,
Joe Mauer.
A-Rod's number one, Griffey, Chipper Jones,
Mauer.
Joe Mauer's four.
So there's basically you're talking about guys who are on the Hall of Fame path or going to be in the Hall of Fame or were on the Hall of Fame path before catastrophic brain injuries. Who could we be talking about right now? I don't know.
Harold Baines is in there.
Sure.
So I'll get you the whole thing here. We're only missing a couple, but it really did. It was striking because, you know, year after year in the draft, we get through this point a few days ago, and it's always, well, you know, college pitching, you know, they're right there. They're going to help you soon. But I think it's a lower floor, lower ceiling in so many cases. And for it to really stack up that way, that you know, what are you trying to do in the draft? What are you trying to do if you're in a Twins position? What should you be trying to do regardless of what position you're in? You're trying with that, whether it's 1-1 or just any first round pick, but especially 1-1, you're trying to win the lottery.
Right.
You want? Do they just get Derek Jeter with better defense? Maybe. You know, there are Jeter-like qualities to this guy, they say. And you were hearing that before the Twins ever came out and talked about that. People were talking about nationally who had been around him. There was this rumbling about a month ago. You know, keep an eye on this Royce Lewis. He has some Jeter-like leadership qualities. And so that got out there a little bit. And I guess we let ourselves be distracted by the concerns over the bat. But that's you should aim high there is no such thing as a safe, truly safe play in an amateur draft like this, then go for it. Adrian Gonzalez, I covered that pick, and a lot of people thought that was a boring pick, $3 million signability guy with the Marlins in 2000. He's fifth already for career WAR, according to Baseball Reference.
Still hanging around in the league.
He's had a very nice career. Daryl Strawberry, who had Hall of Fame talent, no doubt, he was next on the list. He was 1980 first overall pick by the Mets. Terry Ryan was working for them at the time. And Harold Baines was seventh overall to the White Sox out of a Maryland high school in 1977. And then you go B.J. Suroff, Rick Monday, the very first pick in draft history, 1965, Arizona State, and Darren Erstad. So then do you get to David Price and Andy Benes, who was, you know, very solid.
Padres, I believe.
Boris guy, yep. Got right up to the majors. That was when. And so I broke down all 14. If people want to check it out, it's still on the site at twincities.com. And I looked at them because there's some guys that were supposed to be a whole lot more. Floyd Bannister was supposed to revolutionize the game in the 70s. Did not do that. Paul Wilson was supposed to be a 200-inning horse for the Mets in the 90s, Chris Benson, same kind of way, one after another. Of course, we won't even get to Brian Bullington of the Pirates, who he cost Dave Littlefield his job as general manager, basically, and he's now the Tigers farm director. But, you can get a Strasburg in there, you know. Okay,
but he was a pudgy kid that learned how to or got into shape and started to throw hard at San Diego State, right?
Yeah, he was a late bloomer.
Yeah,
and it's going very. Garrett Cole, I would say, is on a good path, although these elbow issues certainly of late give you some concern. So, bottom line is there's no sure thing, and history would point to the fact that a high school position player still has the best chance to be your lottery ticket.
Is Lewis immediately the number one prospect on this team? I mean, I know you're
saying about that today. I think he is.
Yeah, because I mean, when you draft someone 1-1, they probably by definition, should be. But there are a lot of prospect places that will also factor in floor, whereas like a Nick Gordon, obviously, since he's made it to AA, since he's shown competency at AA, and again, not really a bad pick. Granted, he's not Trey Turner, but we'll let a sleeping dog lie there. The fact that he's so close to the big leagues might give him the nudge over Royce Lewis, depending on your evaluations. But he's probably number one as far as ceiling, and as far as if you're going based on, you know, shooting for the stars in terms of where these guys can land, right?
Yeah, and I'm thinking back to a couple of things here. Radcliffe also talked yesterday about, he didn't mention Nick Gordon by name, but he said, everybody around here knows that we've been looking for a shortstop, a long-term shortstop forever, and we think this guy could be the one. Nick Gordon was never mentioned. I'll tell you something else showing that the Twins are still in that search mode, even with Nick Gordon in the system, and that's that what we're about 3 weeks away from the international signing period, July 2nd, and we've known since February that Jelfrey Marte is the Twins are in very good position for the way that whole thing works to sign him for $3 million plus, and he's a shortstop and a very slick shortstop out of the Dominican.
Gotten some Lindor comps, hasn't
you
he?
They'll take that. If you put Marte, if you're introducing middle of the diamond premium defenders with bat upside like Marte and Lewis to your system in the same summer at a combined $10 million or so, $9.5 million plus, that pretty much tells you that, yeah, and I've heard great things about Vilma at AAA. He continues to excite. So I talked to a scout,
He's hitting a little bit, isn't he?
He's hitting a little more. He's adding just a little more strength here and there, more protein shakes, Engel. But I had a scout who saw both Vilma and Gordon when they were together earlier in the year at Chattanooga. And what he said really meant a lot. It crystallized it for me. So I'm not surprised they went with a shortstop in light of this conversation. He said, Vilma taking ground balls next to Gordon was almost embarrassing. That Vilma was so slick and has such soft hands and does everything so naturally. And his comp for him was, he said he could be another Omar Vizquel. Early on, he might not hit much, but he can affect the game defensively and has Omar Vizquel actions. That's who he thought he was watching. Gordon, he said they got to get him off shortstop. He's going to hit. And he's showing that, but he's maybe a left fielder. He's not going to hit for enough power to play third. So maybe there's a Willie Calhoun aspect to him or something. But he said it was sad to watch him because he was getting frustrated, even in pregame, taking grounders. Things that that Vilma would do naturally in a snap of the finger, Gordon was laboring to do. Now, confidence was part of that, and obviously the Twins continued to play Gordon on both sides of the bag at second and short. But when Paul Molitor was as open with his thoughts this spring, saying that he was not sure that Gordon could stay at shortstop, that was a red flag. And then the last thing about this, the scout noted that the great defenders – never seem to get a bad hop. They're always getting the good hop. Nick Gordon is the opposite. For him, when he saw him in a small sample, he said it seemed like Nick Gordon always got the bad hop. Mm-hmm. His instincts, his timing, his footwork, and his hands were not high-end at shortstop.
That's a good point, too, because the good defenders will play the hops as they come, find the good one, attack the good one, or be able to anticipate how many hops the good one will come in and all that. So that's actually, I really like that take a lot. Back to Lewis for one last thing. I want you to grade the pick, not by ABCDF, whatever, but on a pass-fail, you've got to give them a pass on this one, right? I mean, it was a very, very good pick, even despite all the fire spewed on Twitter last night, right?
Lewis?
Royce Lewis, number one overall. On a pass-fail, you definitely give him a pass.
Yeah, because I also understood the larger strategy, the overarching strategy, as I wrote about midday yesterday at TwinCities.com too, that you can't just look at this decision on one alone. Mm-hmm. If the minute you accept the logic, and when Longenhagen's saying those things too, and then generally, no generational talent, no Strasburger, Harper available, a bunch of really interesting guys, but still all just lotto tickets. Which one's gonna cash? Then you had to look at 134 and 37 combined, and I guess really, with with 67-2.
Yeah, the first pick today.
Yeah, the first pick today. We haven't talked about him. LSU signing, Enloe, who has maybe the best curveball they're rated in the high school draft. That tells you something. They pass on Hunter Green because he has no curveball. They take a guy to start the third round that they're probably going to have to give second-round money to, who has a tremendous curveball for his age. So that's something that will be followed, and it shows that they're sticking to their guns. They came away at $14.16 million to spend on the first 10 rounds. They will spend all of that. So no one can say that they're cheap because they didn't pay full slot of 7.77 for the first rounder. Nobody pays full slot for the number one overall pick in the new system.
No one's
gone past 75% of full slot. And that was the Diamondbacks. And they were stupid with Tony La Russa and Dave Stewart in those days. And they left $1.7 million of their total bonus pool on the table that year. They didn't spend it. Of course, we know Tony La Russa is not an executive anymore. He has a title, but he's off on the side, and Mike Hazen is trying to fix things. So 75% of the bonus and again, they compressed the numbers. So the new number 7.77 slot for number one, and well, 75% of that would be $5.8 million. So that's almost a $2 million savings that you could then spread around. I don't think they're going to get that much of a savings, because Scott Boras was the guy on the other end of the phone. But even if they're saving $1 million, $1.5 million, and they move it around and you give half of that to this Enloe kid with the big curveball in round three, you give the other half of that savings, another $750 over slot, say, to the fourth rounder, at least you had a strategy and you stuck with it.
Well, and how about that? You think you've seen everything, and then you live to see the day where the Twins take a Boras guy, and people are like, oh, Twins fans, Twins are being cheap. And you're like, whoa, 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 Twins fans, Twins take a Boras guy, and they're being cheap. How do you even reconcile that in your own mind? And again, yeah, you know, you said that the number one pick, it's every bit about strategy as it is about the fact that no number one pick has signed for slot. In fact, the number one bonus in the slot area is Chris Bryant, who is a number two pick. In fact, right in front of where the Twins took Cole Stewart. I think it was John Gray and then Cole Stewart. And so there's just so much dissonance, or I don't know if you'd call it cognitive dissonance or whatever. The logical fallacies left and right, there's just so many of them, people that are not understanding the process and are falling back on this old Twins are cheap talking point, when in fact there's no way they're going to leave money unspent here. And in fact, then they go on today. They drafted Rooker. We'll talk about him. They drafted Landon Leach. And then Blaine Enloe, strong commit to LSU. Are they pretty good at baseball over in LSU, Mike?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so I mean, they've gone and
they got Ryan Eads, another Boras guy a few years ago in 13, and he had history of arm problems, so hasn't gone as well, but he's looking pretty good in the bullpen lately.
He's pitched all his size Triple A.
He's making progress, but he was a Boras guy in round two back then in 13. But Charlie Barnes, the Clemson soft tosser, changeup guy, a little surprising, and will disappoint Twins Twitter, no doubt. He's the fourth round pick,
mm-hmm.
And that's a slot value of 507. I don't know that they'll have to go doubling that to get him, but that's where they played it at round four. Maybe there'll be somebody who slips to round five who should have been around two. That's what you're looking at with those savings. I really thought that the savings would be reinvested more quickly at 34 and 37, but maybe it's the time to talk about Rooker with that big power and a historic, as Sean Johnson called it, season in the SEC. Certainly, if you like your slash lines, you're not going to, against high-end competition, you're not going to complain about that. Now, have you watched video of that swing?
No, I have not. I posted some video, but I was in hashtag content mode last night to the point where I was finding video from reputable sources, 2080 Baseball, Fangraphs, Baseball America, and just kind of aggregating it as opposed to going back and looking. But obviously, SEC Player of the Year, or SEC Triple Crown, one of the top, I think, 10 in average, top 10 in on base, number one in the nation in slugging, 20-some home runs, almost half of his team's home runs, which this is not pre-BB Core era where guys like Pat Burrell are hitting crazy bombs. Like, this is a really good hitter. Stole some bases. I think I saw 20-plus steals. Fairly good athlete. But there are questions, again, how he'll handle higher-end stuff moving up. But this is a guy that, if all things go well, could be in the, you know, helping this team sooner rather than later. And I just I love the pick, but I also I'm wearing a shirt that says "Fat guys rake today." I like big guys that mash. So, you know, if he makes it to the big leagues in 2 years or a year and a half or next year sometime, I think it's a great pick.
The only thing is, you know, the age is a little concerning. You know, he's a redraft for him. They took him in the 38th round last year.
Yeah, how about that? 38th to the first.
Yeah, 38th round to 35th overall.
Gambling
pick.
On yourself, man.
And he told, as Sean Johnson told us last night, when they finished off with him the last year, when they realized they just didn't have enough money to buy him out from Mississippi State, Rooker told his agent, well, I'm going to go back and I'm going to be a first rounder next year.
Do they still have to ask permission to redraft somebody? I know before they used to have to ask the player for permission to draft them again.
I'm not sure.
Okay, because I thought maybe new CBA, either the one that was 5 years ago or the one that was just this last offseason. I don't know if they still need to ask or that, but...
Well, it was clear that they're expecting to sign him, and I would expect that signing to be right in there in that $2 million range. I believe 1.9 is the slot. But the only thing is he's going to be 23 in November, and so not a whole lot of upside beyond that. And as people have pointed out, you know, Miguel Sano just turned 24, so he's kind of what you see is what you get, but what you saw in the SEC this year was ridiculous.
As far as a mitigation of risk with Lewis, though, if Rooker is anything close to what he's been in college, that's a guy that could have gone earlier. The you know teams, when they make their draft boards and do the risk reward, you know if everybody believed Rooker was anything close to what he was in the minors to be in the big leagues, he probably goes in Kyle Schwarber territory, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Schwarber, at least you could talk yourself at that time. That was an overdraft. That was a gutsy overdraft by them. It's paid off, but you know, you could talk yourself into him having value as a catcher too.
I mean, sure.
That was an Indiana team that Slagers was on, obviously, that went to the College World Series, and he handled some big arms. But you know, obviously, he's not a catcher anymore. The bat was too good, and the catching wasn't good enough. But this guy, I don't know about positional value for Rooker. Even Mississippi State moved him to first base this year. Supposedly he can run around in the corners a little bit. I wouldn't get too excited about the athleticism. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking some Josh Willingham, mid to late career Josh Willingham kind of power and plate discipline. And, you know, that's not too bad for a couple million dollars. So we'll see. But now the catcher...
Maybe Conforto. Maybe that would be a better comp. Conforto was a college kid.
He was a top 10 overall pick.
Right. If he hits like he did, hopefully. Again, yeah. Conforto can play a little center. Obviously, Rooker's not going to do that. But you hope the bat plays, and if it doesn't.
College hitters are not as risky. They tend to be not as risky if they have shown, these days, if they show production. Maybe that'll be good enough. It sounds like he might go right to Cedar Rapids and a quick stop there and maybe finishing the year even in the Florida State League and go from there. I mean, he's going to, like you say, he's going to be 23 going into next season, his first full professional season. Mm-hmm. That's it's almost like getting some sort of military service guy. But he'll be a leader in that clubhouse, I have to think.
Oh,
but, you know, and as far as the number 37 pick, a little surprising, a Texas commit, a Canadian who converted from catcher to the mound, but
and Texas is good too.
Yeah, you know, it's a big-bodied guy who they love his mechanics, and they like that he's touched 96, and they think that there's a lot to work with. But not exactly the kind of guy I anticipated in that slot, who maybe would have tumbled out of the first round. And this is a good time to say Sam Carlson. And maybe you guys can explain. I don't know. I haven't seen the references. Yet the explanation for how he goes from considered a top 20 value all the way to 55, other than signability. And if signability was the issue, and the Twins saw him as much as anybody, and they had savings to burn, and it didn't seem like they're going to need to split those savings on both guys there, I am surprised. I'm frankly surprised. I do not know yet what the concern was other than signability.
The one other thing I think of is pitching is so focused, obviously, with the Twins and the organization. I do worry about a little bit of like the savior complex that people would want the local kid, with the added pressure of obviously a lot of people that probably saw him in high school could easily go down to Target Field and watch him.
Mm-hmm.
Just the narrative of the local kid kind
Although
of running around.
Although getting him to Target Field is the biggest hurdle to leap, in theory. So,
right.
I feel like if he can overcome the pressure to get to Target Field, there's probably less once you get there. But I also think there's I don't want to say it's the Mitch Brown factor necessarily, but remember, everyone here. And Mike, were you here for the Barrios draft, or was that the year before you came on the beat?
I came in 13, so he was already in the system, Buxton, Barrios.
So Mitch Brown was the Rochester Century kid that everyone thought the Twins were going to take 30-whatever. They end up taking this unknown kid from Puerto Rico named Jose Barrios, and you see him cry on the TV, and you see the workouts, and you're like, well, all right. You know, I know the Twins have been bad for a couple years now, but we'll give Terry Ryan the benefit of the doubt. At least I know that was me. I'm sure the rest of people on Twitter back when Twitter was a little different weren't willing to do the same. But who's the one pitching this Thursday at Target Field against Ariel Miranda and the Seattle Mariners? And who's the one at AA walking a batter per inning right now? Nice ERA, 3.52. Had a really tough year, 5-plus ERA in high A last year. And then I looked. Mitch Brown is working in the bullpen at AA, walking 7.5 batters per nine. We get tied up in this local angle, that newsy local angle, and it's fun. Don't get me wrong. They drafted Austin, I can't think of his last name, the kid from Century, and signed him back before draft slots were a big deal. And all,
took Logan Shore late and really tried to sign him.
But you can't get too tied up in local stuff. If Sam Carlson was named Billy Jones and was from Fort Wayne, Indiana, would you feel as strongly about him as you do Sam Carlson? No. And it's just a natural tendency. And so when I see people tweeting, the Twins are going to have to answer for this, it's like... Really? He went 20 picks or 18 picks afterward. Apparently, 17 teams or however many teams had picks in between there were like, we can't sign him. Or, maybe we like someone who plays baseball all year round or plays in a better climate and is better acclimated. Whatever the reason, the Twins weren't alone in this assessment. If he goes the pick after, I understand the thinking, oh, man, that's weird they didn't take him. He went 38th.
Yeah, yeah.
But he went, 18 picks later. Again... It would be nice to see him, especially because, the way the Twins did things in the past, Terry Steinbach, Paul Molitor, Dave Winfield, they got these Minnesota guys at the twilight of their career. Then there was Joe Mauer and Pat Neshek at the beginning of their careers, and that was kind of cool. And so you'd like to keep your guys around here, and, you get the sense that keep your guys at home, kind of like the Richard Pitino thing or the PJ Fleck thing. But it's not quite exactly the same either. I think we got too tied up in the Sam Carlson thing and that he was 15th in a lot of boards. When, in fact, who knows? Maybe Landon Leach will be a lot better than him.
Well, and I was going to say, maybe Minnesota should leverage kind of the local tie later in the career. Like, let someone else develop the player and go through all that and get him to the big leagues and ferry him in and then, bring him over.
Yeah, let Seattle develop him or let him go to Tampa Bay or whatever, whoever.
That's a better approach.
Yeah.
Then they're going to buy him. They're going to buy him on a free agent.
Well, sure, yeah. Obviously, that's been their MO in the last.
Right. But I'm just saying you might be able to get a player from Minnesota that otherwise wouldn't consider coming to the Twins.
Well, I don't know. This kid was interesting, and it wasn't just local coverage that can certainly skew things because we can be provincial here as a transplant. I've noticed this.
I bet that was an interesting dynamic for you to understand coming to Minnesota.
Yeah, and speaking of draft stuff, this is kind of cool because. In the years that I was at the Sun Sentinel in South Florida, first basemen that came out of the area high in the draft were included Eric Hosmer and Anthony Rizzo.
Wow, that's some talent right there.
From Broward County, not Miami guys either. And then they end up winning World Series in back-to-back years as first basemen. Yeah, so
pretty awesome.
I don't think there's anybody else from Broward County playing first that you could see making that a three-peat. But
did they say bringing it back to Broward County, baby? Like Royce Lewis said last night about Southern Orange County. That was pretty funny.
The history of Broward County, not too good, but people don't get too wrapped up in it because, I don't know, there's not as much pride. A lot of people are from other areas down there. But here there's pride, and it would have been cool for Sam to be a first-rounder and make some history in that regard out of high school. Obviously, Glenn Perkins was a first rounder out of the U. But my sense, I remember reading a story a few weeks ago in Baseball America. Sam was important enough that he got a full feature, a pre-draft feature, and talking about the yoga work that he's done to improve his flexibility and his concentration and in the way he's sharpened his slider and picking the brains of guys who have pretty good track records. The narrative was there too, Brandon. It wasn't just the geography. Mm-hmm. And I think we all root for him to do very well.
So with the fourth pick, I believe first pick today, Blaine Enloe, LSU commit. And if you weren't on board, let's just say you weren't on board with the first three picks and how it went on Monday, how much does that bridge the gap to, okay, there was a plan in place here, and these guys know what they're doing and are trying to restock a farm system that has lost a significant amount of talent to graduation in the last, let's say, 20 to 24 months?
Well, I'm sure that the metrics on that curveball are probably really good if he's rated by scouts as the best curveball in the high school class. So that's encouraging. As we mentioned earlier in the show, this modern new idea that that the curveball cannot be taught. You either have it or you don't. Which kind of reminds me of Bill Parcells' old football line about rookies: if they don't bite as pups, they're probably not going to bite, is what he would say.
Oh,
you could
man.
Tell.
I like
you
that
could,
a lot.
You could tell. Yeah, you would know. He that was his thing. You could tell in the first mini camp if the guy was going to be any good. But I do think there's room for improvement. That's a big part of scouting. But the curveball in particular might be a different animal. And then noticing here that one guy, not a lot of people, I don't watch a ton of college baseball, but to make sure that I was curious about Kyle Wright when it really was reaching a crescendo over the weekend. And the catcher at Vanderbilt really caught my eye with a couple of pop times that were tremendous, and the way he moved and the way he handled this guy. He was a senior sign. He's a late bloomer, but the Pirates took this Jason DeLay in the fourth round. And I would have thought that a team that had spent as much time on maybe the Twins had a fifth or sixth round grade on him, whatever. Mm-hmm. Twins would like, I mean, Ben Rortvedt's not going that well for the second rounder from Wisconsin, not hitting at all as they've accelerated him to the Midwest League, not having a good Midwest League. And they're gonna. I'm surprised they haven't taken a catcher yet through right. round four. And Jason DeLay they passed on in round four for a soft-tossing lefty from Clemson. Little that I know. I have very limited knowledge. My draft board is you could put it on the back of a napkin. But Jason DeLay caught my eye. I'd be very surprised if he weren't a top 10 prospect for the Pirates in coming years as he goes through their system.
So when you reflect on this draft, though, you come away from it generally positive to start, I would have to say.
Well, you keep trying to get these snap judgments out of me.
No. I just mean for the fact that all the snap judgments have been so overwhelmingly negative.
Have they?
On Twitter.
Yeah.
And I feel like,
keeping in mind the Twitter is a cesspool. We understand, you can't, it's a big picture.
I can see a framework here. I can see competency and a general idea.
Yeah, and I'd even break it down based on what we know and what we've heard from and about Royce Lewis so far. The narrative there. And by the way, Scott Boras' clients are more expensive typically for a reason. He can represent anybody he wants. He always has 100-plus clients. He doesn't take on anybody who's going to embarrass him generally or who's going to just be terrible.
A schmuck, basically.
He does not mess with people like that. Not to overstate it, but especially draft class guys, you've probably already
he's done some of the vetting for you.
He's got yes, exactly. You've already cleared a hurdle just to be worthy of his advising. Mm-hmm. Let's say so.
I don't think the FCC or whatever or advising. Rob Manfred is listening.
Well, we all know how it works, but that doesn't guarantee anything.
Sure,
we just mentioned Ryan Eads, and there have been plenty.
Mike Pelfrey.
Great guy.
Love Mike Pelfrey.
Great guy and had us, should have been better. Still,
lots of stab
wounds. Still should tell you. He should be better. But obviously, you have 100-plus clients at any time. It's not going to be perfect. There have been some real lunkheads and some real failures. But in these draft classes, there is a reason that there becomes a Boras premium, and it doesn't sound like the Twins had to pay the Boras premium. I mean, that's the amazing thing. Mackenzie Gore, another Boras client. Jaron Kendall, another one. I really liked him out of Vanderbilt. He dropped all the way to the Dodgers. They're going to pay the Boras premium probably at 22
or
whatever.
Yeah, Rich getting richer there. Holy smokes. He was in the number one discussion early,
as a bit of a reach. Backing up to the question, The Twins did. Do they deserve the trust of the fan base over how they executed the number one overall pick for just the third time in franchise history? Short answer is yes.
Okay, so we've gone draft heavy. I only got one more thing for you, and I want to get away from the draft, and I'm sure you probably do too, but it's still going on. Twins purchased a contract of Nick Turley. Obviously, the numbers are off the charts. I talked to Chris Jimenez in the clubhouse yesterday. We actually did a video podcast. Check it out on Cold Omaha's YouTube page. He is, as Mike knows, a fabulous quote. We did a video pod, and he and I
It's going to be great. Yeah.
We had so much fun. Already got a handful of page views. And hopefully that'll blow up, because I know he's not a high-profile player, but he's a great quote.
How'd you do that?
Mr. Schreier here, you can hear his...
Oh, I thought maybe we had a selfie stick going.
Oh, my gosh. You can hear his trademark laugh. My wife and I watched it last night, and she's like, oh, it sounds like Tom's in the room. I'm like, I know. So I asked Chris.
Lock the doors.
Yeah.
What does Jimenez think of your laugh?
He thinks it's goofy.
Batten down the hatches.
Pillsbury.
Lock him out. Yeah. So anyway, Chris, I asked Jimenez about the Falvey-Levine regime. I got to make sure I get that out.
Falvey.
Yep. Yeah, there you go.
Trademark.
I don't want to steal that, though, but you get a little tongue-tied. I asked him about, you know, obviously Corey Kluber was the Vinny Pastano trade. The idea that you can only buy aces or draft aces, sometimes you need to create guys, or you find guys who are not doing something they can do. Corey Kluber wasn't throwing a two-seamer in Double A with the Padres, and they plucked him, got him to do that, and boom, he became a Cy Young winner. I'm not saying Turley's that kind of guy, not at all. But I love the process, the path, and I think he's got a chance to be something decent. Jimenez, I keep wanting to call him Chris, which is a little bit too ambiguous for me. Jimenez said you could see the nerves against the Giants. The Giants have the worst offense in baseball, and he gave up 9 hits in 4 innings. So on and so forth. But 8 swinging strikes and 75 pitches, you can see the stuff is clearly there. I think the Twins have a chance to have pulled off something pretty interesting, even if he can hang as a league average guy this year, and maybe as he learns the big league game a little bit, become a number 3, number 4 starter. I'm just fascinated by what he brings to the table and what his short, medium, and long-term future could mean to this club.
I don't know if I have much to add to that, but what just popped into my head was, I want to throw this by, you know, I always liked Key and Peele, and they had this skit about the hype man. And I'm thinking that Chris Jimenez is kind of a hype man for anything. If I mean, can you possibly be around him and feel bad about yourself?
No, because he said he was a 6-foot-tall, white, all-conference center. Basketball, all-conference center.
In a league where, like, 3 guys went D1.
Yeah. Well, he was a Mark Madsen hustle kind of guy.
I could see that,
And so we're just kind of, you know, busting chops there. And then Kyle Gibson asks him if he was drafted in 1997 because he didn't even have a cell phone. And I'm telling you guys, I don't like to brag about my work, but it was a really fun show. And I don't like to brag. I like to share it, but I don't like to brag.
Sure.
And we had Tom laughing. We had Tom laughing the
whole time. I'm laughing just hearing the synopsis. Chris Jimenez, I'm going to call him Dr. Feelgood. You can't be around him and not feel better about your day.
Right.
And that's why he's around. And, of course, the fact that he's made 5 relief appearances in the first 60 games.
That is mind-blowing.
It's astounding for a first-place team.
He's shooting for 7, though. That's the record, I think.
And he's asked for multiple other ones that he didn't get. Like, that's what's mind-blowing is, like, this team is so weird. It's so weird. Like, they just have a bullpen bow up every once in a while.
But here's the deal. I always said if you can't be good, you should be young or interesting. The Twins are good. They're young. They're super interesting because you look at the run differential and you're like, what in the heck? But they have these blowouts, and then the next day it's like it never even happened.
Do you think
it's so funny?
Do you think Jimenez could eventually work his way into a higher leverage role where he just comes in to mess up your swing in like the 6th inning, and he just comes in to face
in for relief against when Matt Belisle got into trouble in San Francisco? Yeah. Oh, he throws 68 on the black, pumping it.
Big development. Not to ruin the whole video, but he did say he's trying to do a knuckleball.
He's working on knuckleball
which I thought that's what it was all along.
Yeah, well. His spin rate is nil. He's got zero spin
rate. He's got the fish ball. But it's fascinating. And it's going to sound crazy, but I'm seeing enough. I know they destroyed some balls late last night. I think they're undervaluing what they could do with him in very small doses. Just like, let's say you're in a series where when Nelson Cruz had no trouble with it the other night. But there's some people that you bring a guy in who's just so different, and of course you're gonna, as a hitter, you're gonna naturally tense up. You're facing a backup catcher.
Yeah.
Now it's one thing when it's ha-ha time and you're up by 10 runs, but what if you're facing a backup catcher for the final out of the sixth
after Barrios has been in or something? The drop off.
How much will that mess with you? A 30 mile an hour difference in the fastball, and I guess he's throwing changeup. But whatever, 25, 30 mile an hour difference, and it's a backup catcher, and you've got a runner on or whatever, and you make an out there, you're mad at yourself anyway, and then it's Chris Giménez. So yeah. I wouldn't put it past him to be the first middle reliever backup catcher, and not just in blowouts, because, again, he seems to be into it. He seems to be – you're telling us he's got a knuckle. And if he adds a knuckleball, honestly, the knuckleball is the great –
Equalizer, right?
For anybody.
All right, Dickey's still hucking it at 44 or whatever he is.
Isla Borders threw a knuckleball. I mean,
right.
Wakefield, look what he did to reinvent himself. There's no reason that if Dozier apparently has a very good knuckleball. I don't think we're going to see that. But leave all the doors open and see where it takes you. But Chris Giménez definitely is a guy who outrun all expectation in his career to this point, and he's not done yet.
What's your quick Nick Turley synopsis, though? We did kind of circle the wagon.
I saw Turley in person for the first time and only time this year on a backfield on Bill Smith Field down in Fort Myers when Phil Hughes threw a game on an off day, and early in spring, and Nick Turley was the opposing pitcher, and I knew they had signed him in the offseason. I knew he was not related to Bob Turley, the Yankees great, and aside from that, I didn't know much, and I'm seeing this guy, and I'm seeing the radar guns, and it's 93-94. From the left side, with movement, with secondary pitches, and I'm saying to one of the Twins people, I say, "Who is that guy?"
Mm-hmm.
And did you know he threw that hard? And no, they didn't. I mean, that's kind of stuff just came. And he's a driveline guy, I believe. He's definitely a weighted
ball guy
who here's one where they threw Seth Rosine against the wall. I thought they'd give him more time. He's a driveline guy, and they ended up releasing him. Great guy, local guy. But Nick Turley might be the one of all these weighted ball guys that it sticks because, like you say, the swing and miss – It gets your attention, and he looked like he belonged in San Francisco. They had a quick leash, short leash on him, but he looked like he belonged. I'm interested to see what he can figure out.
Well, I wonder if when Hector Santiago comes back, assuming that's soon, shoulders are tricky, but I don't think it's a long term thing. If it'll be maybe Mejia that gets sent back after last night's outing, and Turley gets a longer look. I think at this age, you're not going to ruin Turley. You're probably not going to ruin Mejia because he's a pretty finished product too, but maybe he needs to do one thing or another. You want a better command of the fastball. You can justify sending back Mejia, whereas with Turley, it's like, well, yeah, why not give him a look?
You'd rather run Turley out there with his stuff than Adam Wilk. Right?
Yeah, Chris Heston as a starter.
Yeah,
I'm
pleased that they got Turley up here because I believe it was just about a month ago that people on Twitter were mocking our Nick Turley updates, anybody's Nick Turley update.
Who's laughing now?
And saying, this is just organizational filler, he's nothing, look at his career. And here's a guy who improved himself in his late 20s using the latest technologies and using driveline weighted ball system and using his adaptability to get swings and misses.
Great stuff today, Mike. Let's get you on again soon with Cody. We got to get that show lined
up. Yeah.
I know little brother Cody would love to be on with Mike, and hopefully we can figure out how to do it in here. He's Mike Berardino. See you at the park tonight.
Yes, sir.
Tom Schreier behind the glass, working the keys, twisting the dials and the knobs. I'm Brandon Warren. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.